Welcome to Ira's Everything Bagel, where I talk with intriguing people about everything, their passions, pursuits, and points of view. Well, my guest has a passion for success, but only because he was not afraid of failure. He says that if you look at failure as feedback, it becomes a learning experience, a path forward to success. Adam Haston is author of The Wonder Effect, an adventurous guide for igniting your passions and pursuing your calling. It's available on Amazon, Barnes Noble, and all the usual places. And for everything about Adam, go to adamhaston.com, and you can follow him on Instagram, LinkedIn, and X. And Adam, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it, Ira.
Sure. A quote from your introduction. Culture perpetuates a belief that you are not capable or qualified unless deemed so by an expert. For some things, of course, credentials are necessary, but on the whole, this myth limits a vision of what is possible. It influences your identity by reducing what opportunities you believe are available. And under this misguided thinking, you feel you have a limited amount of skills and therefore a limited amount of opportunities in life, end quote. Well, that's quite a handful, but I think it makes a lot of sense. How did you come to this realization?
it's something that I have explored. It's something that I've thought through. You almost see it everywhere. But ultimately what ends up happening is you end up having this experience in life where when you're trying to think about or decide what you want to do. Let's say you want to be a coach. It depends on what type of coach, but let's say it's a life coach, for example. So automatically what you then think is, okay, what's the training and what is the credentials that I'm going to have to get that gives me the stamp that says, okay, that's okay. If you wanted to go into, if you wanted to be a mechanic, you'd have to go to a trade school in order to have that certification in order to be able to do that. So we have this thing. And again, there's good reasons for having those trainings and for having those certifications. I don't dismiss that there are positives to it, but I also think that in the aggregate, there's a lot of consequences to that type of thinking. And that type of thinking basically leads you to prevent yourself from taking and exploring next steps in order to going a direction, because you get stuck in a loop of, let's call it paralysis by analysis, which is that you just keep on this learning cycle where you actually don't get into the doing. And so I often advocate for a mix of both, but often with a need to take action first. And that action has to be something that's leading you towards there. And then when you take action and then you pair that with learning, you end up having a actual experience, and that changes you as a person, that changes your capacities, and it gives you a certain confidence to be able to continue on. So ultimately that's where I'm coming from with that.
Okay. And this explains why I am the way I am, because I had a mechanic operate on my brain, and they weren't really credentialed for that, or even non-credentialed for that. I think they did a little too much work on it.
Who's telling you that's the case?
The mechanic, you know, who was working on my brain. I just let him do it because he said he had complete confidence. He read a few books and he didn't need the credential. But anyway, only kidding. Tell us a little bit about your background, then we'll get more into the book itself and why you wrote it and what the really meat of it is.
Sure. So I have, I basically would say that I have unconventional paths to success. I've done a whole host of different things, anything from being a television producer to a rabbi in a synagogue, to running a school, to being in real estate. So I've done a whole diverse set of things. And I often say that those pieces of experience that you have are patches in your personal quilt of experience and your quilt that makes you someone that's completely different than anyone else in the entire world. And so that's the justification that I would say that you should pursue things that you have a passion for or that you're uncertain about, because in that pursuit, you become different and you're able to offer something different to the world.
But if you think back in terms of, let us say, the 40s and the 50s, I think changed a little bit in the 60s, but in the 40s and the 50s, generally speaking, you were considered a little bit irresponsible if you decided to explore this thing or that thing. You were just expected to do one thing, whether it's work in a factory, become a mail carrier, become a doctor, whatever it is. And then that was it. And you were going to do that for the next 30, 40, 50 years. Where did that awareness come that, or that change come society-wise, and then your own particular perspective, where we could actually do more than one thing or explore more than one thing in our road to figuring out what we're really passionate about.
So firstly, you made me think of something that I had not thought about beforehand as a way to answer your previous question. But what I would say is that in that time period that you're talking about, again, I wasn't born in that time period for those.
Oh, I understand.
For the
but, no, but you can read the history of it. And know
right,
it.
Correct. No, I really enjoy history a lot. And so that's why I'm saying this. So basically the school systems were created to provide workers for the industrial age. And so what you're talking about is that outgrowth of those systems that got created to basically produce workers for industrialization. So that's why everything becomes very fixed in what is being produced and what they're expecting for the people that they're trying to produce. So I would say to you that what I'm talking about has always been around. It's just that this is something that I refer to in the book as synthetic environments. So we take the fact that this is what we were raised in. We take the fact that there's these school systems that are set up in this way to produce and create people that are willing and able to work in manufacturing or industrialized situations. And we assume that that's a limitation that we have. So when you say, like, where did it come from, this ability to step outside of that? That's something that I would say has always existed. And you particularly see that, I would say that there's different fields where you see that, but I think you see that if you want in the arts, in the film industry, you'll see that in entrepreneurship and throughout. So that's, the people that end up stepping outside of what's expected of them in those time periods that you're talking about have created tremendously good things for the world and tremendous success for themselves.
So from your perspective, you're writing this book for the people who never really have thought about or instinctively know that they could try different things that could work rather than just being on one path.
Of course. So in the very beginning of the book, one of the things that I try to get people to understand is that you think that you have certain limitations. And the reason that you think that is because of a whole host of factors. But there's an example that I give in there about the way that elephants get trained. You don't hear a lot about elephants injuring the people that are in charge of them. And the reason for that is because at the youngest age of an elephant being born, they basically put a stake in the ground and they tie a rope to that elephant. And the elephant at that age doesn't have the actual energy to be able to pull that stake out. And they keep training the elephant with that stake and with that rope. And when I say stake, I'm talking about a peg in the ground, just to be clear. Right. So what then ends up happening is that as the elephant grows and it becomes much stronger than it was as a child, it still latches on and still thinks that it doesn't have the strength to pull that stake out. And so it's something that gets ingrained and impressed upon the elephant through that upbringing and through that training that they don't have that strength and they don't have that capacity. So that's sort of a mentality that I would advocate that people should understand and be aware of, because yes, it's something that we grow up with. We grow up with a lot of these ideas of the limits that we have. And there's a quote that I have in the book. I think it's from Schopenhauer, which basically says that we take our limits of our field of vision to be the limits of the world. And I think that that's an important idea to be aware of. And I think that it helps people reframe what's possible and be aware that the thoughts that they have of what is possible for themselves and for the world are not necessarily true just because we believe them.
I want to quote again from your book, but before I do, it seems there's a fine line between, you mentioned the elephant and the stake. It's a fine line between training and abuse. I mean, you're stunting the mental development, if you think about it, of an intelligent animal by them thinking that they can't pull that stake out. Not you personally, but I'm talking about trainers.
Again, I'm not sure why it's done that way. And yes, I probably would say that might be the case. I'm not sure if that's changed, but it's something that I definitely have read as part of the training.
Gotcha. Let me quote from your book again. This is not a manual that will solve all your problems. Instead, it gives you the tools necessary for exploring your ambitions and embracing discovery, adventure, and personal growth through engaging in wonder. It gives you permission to succeed, unquote, or end quote. That's a good point, because what you're doing is you're providing tools. You're not simply saying, here's what I have found in my own research, and I'm going to share that with you in terms of a concept. You're actually giving tools to work with for the reader.
Sure, exactly. So there's a thing that has been that has frustrated me when it comes to the genre of, let's say, personal growth or self-help, whichever. And one of those things is that I feel like for a lot of people, they may feel that those things that are advocated in there are unrealistic. And what I tried to do with the book is basically provide rational and philosophical underpinnings for the approach that I'm arguing that people should take. And one of those is that, and you had mentioned, I think, at the beginning of this, that the idea of when it comes to failure. So I think, and this is what I advocate for, is that people think of failure in a certain way. And because people are afraid of failing, that's what will inhibit them from going forward. And so one of the things that I make the argument for is the realization that you're going to fail. And so just if you start out with the realization that you're going to fail, everybody fails. We've been failing our entire lives. And what I mean by that is that from the time that you were born till now, you have failed. When you started to walk, you fell down. You kept falling down and falling down. And what I basically say is that failure is a mechanism for us to learn. So if you start with the idea that if you want to approach something, if you want to do something, if you want to accomplish something, the idea that you're going to fail should not be what inhibits you. It's a given that that's going to happen. And what failure does and should be is a feedback loop for your learning. So I'm slightly afraid to keep attacking schools, but there's a famous quote from Mark Twain, which says, "Don't let school get in the way of education." It's something that I've adopted, and I'm a very, very big believer in learning and learning and learning. I just don't think that you only need to get it from one source. So one of the things, just to illustrate this idea, is this idea when it comes to testing. So in schools, when you are given tests, I feel like teachers and administration, they put too much emphasis on the scores. And when I say that, I think that the scores are important, but not as an indicator of the, let's say, the student's self-worth or their worth, where you go into a parent-teacher conference and the teacher tells you about your child and they say what his grades are. So for me, the grades are really, again, a feedback loop. So if you're trying to test a child on vocabulary and they get an 80 or they get a 70 or they get a 60, from my perspective, what's more significant is that as a learning tool for the teacher to be aware of where their student is in order to fill in the gaps of the knowledge that's missing. So if they got a 70, that's telling them that they know 70% of the material, but there's 30% gap there, as opposed to looking at it as a tool to be able to evaluate and say what the success of the child is. So that's sort of my perspective on it. And that's why I'm trying to share that idea of what I see as failure, and that it is a given. You're not always going to be at 100%, but the point is that that gives you a way to assess what it is that you need to fill in.
But on the other hand, too, I'll play devil's advocate. If the sure. student has not an incapacity, but an inability to retain as much knowledge, if student A cannot retain as much information or knowledge as student B, so they score less on a test, there's not much the teacher can do to fill in the gap if the gap is coming internally from the student who just can't process that much information and retain it.
Right. So if you're talking about if you're talking about exceptions to the rule, that's one thing. If you're talking about the average, I'm talking about that the average person can learn and the average person has the ability to retain information. It would be like saying, you know, that a person that's brain dead wouldn't be able to retain information. I'm not talking about the exceptions. I'm talking about the average person.
Okay. No, that makes sense. When you wrote a book, you obviously were writing the book and then you had to come up with a title. So how did the Wonder Effect become the title? Was there just based on, it just came to you on one day, you were just sitting there and just popped in your head, or were you just thinking more and more, okay, I'm writing about all these different things and, you know, embracing failure because you're going to learn from it. And, you know, you could succeed if you if you just learn to just come to at least get comfortable, maybe not embrace, but get comfortable with failure. As you said, we fail from the very beginning. I mean, we try to walk and we fall down and we do other things. You know, when you learn to drive, you're not going to be the best driver initially. Or later in years, you get start feeling again with, you know, they take away your license. But where did you come up with the title? It was a longer roundabout question for the simple one, which was, where did you get the title from?
So I was trying to figure out, like many, well, what would be the encapsulating point that could sort of sum up what the approach is that I'm advocating for and why. So as I was saying before, that there is this this hesitation that I think that people have to go after things that they may have wanted to go after. And again, there's a whole host of reasons that that might be the case, but there is this hesitancy. And one of those things, and again, obviously, this is one of the chapters in the book, but one of the things that that I address in there is this idea of the imposter syndrome. And again, this comes back to this same idea that we talked about a little bit earlier, and that is that people don't feel enough, and they will conclude for themselves that they shouldn't even necessarily go down that path, because who am I to be able to do that? That thing, whatever that thing is. And so there's this story that that I like to reference, and that is the fact that everybody has imposter syndrome. I think 70 to 80% of people have experienced it. And one of the examples that I like to give about it is this example where there was a Nobel Prize winning physicist that he was interviewed, and he was asked the very question about whether or not he ever had imposter syndrome. And his response to that was that that his answer was, yes, I did. And he gave the time when he did. And what he said was part of the ritual of winning the Nobel Prizes is that they have you write your name in the book with the past Nobel Prize winners. And he started looking down the list, and some of the people that he saw in the book were, for example, Einstein. And he thought to himself, can I compare myself to Einstein? I'm no Einstein. And the reason I like to reference this point is because the very person who should feel deserving of being amongst the great would be the person that's winning a Nobel Prize. Yet that person themselves didn't feel deserving of it. So the reason I reference this and the reason that I point this out is because it's the one thing that often inhibits people from doing anything, because they don't feel that there's anything special that they can contribute in whatever way. And why should they be the one to do X, Y, and Z? And what I like to do with the idea of the wonder effect is basically wonder, maybe turn that question around and why not me? And if I have a desire to do this thing, maybe that's a signal that I'm being pulled and called on to go after and to do that very thing. And the reason maybe it's me that should be doing that or should be contributing in that way is because of all of world history has led for me to be this person with my unique experiences and my desire to solve this particular problem. That's something that maybe I should be going after. So there's a person that I quote in the book who is someone that I has had deep influence on me. He's known as the Lubavitcher Rebbe. And he says, when you see what needs to be fixed and how to fix it, then you have found a piece of the world that God has left for you to complete. And I do think that there's this mission-driven idea and this purpose-driven life. And so this is some of the approach that I, in the way that I'm looking at it. And so when going back to the actual question is, why wonder? Because you should be wondering whether or not you're fit to do that and whether or not you can create that fitness in just simply pushing forward and learning forward. And so that's where the book title comes from.
So given what I've just heard from you, that clearly tells me that your rabbinic background has helped you in terms of writing the book and presenting what your ideas are about the book.
Most definitely. I when I was 16 years old, I chose to leave my high school early, and I went to study abroad in Israel. And it was this is like time, this was in the 90s, and it was a time before internet essentially, and before being able to really explore anything online. And it was a decision that was not easy necessarily to make. One of my parents was not advocating for me to leave high school early for all the responsible reasons. And it was the one decision that I think has had the greatest impact in my life in many, many ways. So, sorry, I'm not sure if I'm answering. You said about the rabbinic background. Yes. So, and as a result of that, it led me to studying for probably about 7 years before I ended up getting my rabbinical ordination, which I ended up doing after I got married. And it led me on a very beautiful path in life. And again, I was very fortunate to be able to have the experience that I had.
Yeah, it was just the way you were explaining things. I could see your rabbinic background coming to the fore, or I sensed it, and which was good because you answered my question, but you first laid out a whole predicate. And I was afraid you weren't going to answer the question. I always remember the question because that's my one skill. Is that I ask a guest a question, and if they answer something and they don't answer the question, even if it's 5 minutes later, I'll come back to it because I remember that it wasn't answered. Even if it's a trivial question, but so that's fine. When you sat down to write the book, did you have a specific group or portion of the population in mind, or are you really looking at it from just a general perspective, a general population perspective? In other words, everyone could benefit from the book.
The guidance that I was given on how to think about writing a book is that you can't write a book for the masses. You have to write it for the advice that's given is for an avatar. So I'll share with you that avatar, but ultimately what I want to express with that is that the book is really written for people to use as a way to think about how they should be deciding from this moment forward how they should be living their life. So there's a certain population that's more obvious for, and then there's a secondary population that's less obvious. So the population that it's most obvious for is, I would call it the 18 to 25 year old. So for me, the avatar that I used was because of the time period. I used my oldest son. He was at the time in that age range. And I wanted to distill all of the advice and guidance that I could possibly give to him on how to think about leading his life, living his life, and personally growing. How could I advise him in a way that would be meaningful for him? And if anybody else ended up reading it, what would it be valuable to them? And I felt I worked very hard on making sure that this provided that, because I didn't want people to have special conditions by which they would read it. And they only if they were special in a certain way, could this advice be helpful? The secondary group that I think that I'm referencing in this is, I'll say, everybody else. And what I mean by that is that people assume that from the time, let's say from 18 to 25, you made a decision, you started going down a certain path. So people don't necessarily question when they're in their 30s or when they're in their 40s or beyond, whether or not they can shift paths. So this book is extremely helpful for that age bracket too. But the thinking of that is, or the reasoning that I'm talking about that is because we sometimes think that you can only make the decision then. I would say, and I would argue, that in every moment you're actually making a decision. So if you decide to be indecisive or you decide not to make a decision, you should be aware that you're making a decision to stay. And if you're deciding to stay, would all things being equal, would you be staying and continuing to do what you're doing right now, knowing everything you know? And if the answer is no, you'd rather do something else. And then you're looking for, how could that even make any sense? How could you do it? Isn't it risky? Isn't it terrible? So this book will provide the underlying infrastructure, the underlying scaffolding that you may need help with in order to pursue something that's different.
Yeah, you make a good point too, that these decision-making abilities can happen at any age. You could decide at age 80 that you, while you've done A and B your whole life, now you're going to try C. I mean, if you're in good health, and there's no limitation on your physical abilities, you could do whatever pretty much you want if you make that decision. And by not making the decision, you've made a decision.
Right. I agree. But I would also like just to push back a little bit. So one of the things that you said in that response was if a person is in good health. Okay. So the reason I want to push back on that for a second is because that itself becomes its own decision. Meaning you, again, I'm talking about within not special circumstances. This is somebody that has a diagnosis of X, Y, and Z. Again, I don't want to give any specific examples because I feel like people nitpick on everything. The point I'm trying to say is that if basically what's led you here is because of your own actions, there's an idea. I'm trying to remember the name of it. It's called, it's two types of problems. There's two types of problems. One's a technical problem and one's an adaptive problem. And this is this idea is one of the ideas that I like to discuss in the book. And the idea of an adaptive problem versus a technical problem, I'll explain. So a technical problem is that there's a problem and there's a solution. So let's say it's you have a something that's missing a screw. So if you get the screw and you put it back in, so then you've solved the technical problem.
Right.
An adaptive problem is where you're the problem. So in other words, when it comes to and this is why it's coming up because you were talking about health.
Sure.
So an adaptive problem is you're the problem. And that means that the decisions that you've continually made has led you to be in a situation where you're not healthy. So again, taking this mindset is to say, question that. So like you can make a different decision now, just because right now you're not in a healthy state of being, you can make a decision that you are going to be healthy and that you are going to research or at least incrementally get a little bit healthier and take actions to become a little bit better than you were until now. So that itself can then lead to all the other consequences that you were saying. So in other words, you were saying that only if a person's healthy, then they can do X, Y, and Z. So I'm saying, okay, fine. If the person wasn't healthy, then that itself becomes its own first mission in order to lead to the further.
Yeah. Fair enough. That's a very good point. Before I let you go, we have about a minute left. Okay. What would you like people to take away from the book as the main concept?
Main concept is wonder what is possible if you decide to pull the thread on your interests, on your passions, and what's possible. And that ultimately what you should realize is that the very thing that is pulling you forward is a sense of purpose and a sense of mission. You're here for a reason. You're here to do something. And so if you're feeling pulled towards something, it's not a magical, information, but it is an interest and it is a signal that you are interested in being pulled that way. And if you pull that thread of interest, you will be surprised at all of the things that could come about if you're willing to put the time, effort, and energy in pursuing that. You might not end up getting to that thing, but you will be a different and better person as a result of that.
Well, that's a great way to leave it. My guest has been Adam Haston. He's the author of The Wonder Effect, an adventurous guide for igniting your passions and pursuing your calling. It's available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and all the usual places. And for everything about Adam, go to adamhaston.com, and you can follow him on Instagram, LinkedIn, and X. And Adam, thanks for being on the show.
Sure, of course. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. And join us every Thursday for a new schmear on Ira's Everything Bagel.